This podcast is brought to you by Aspire Planning Group, insurance creating a better future for you and your family. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hello, I'm your host, Louise Taffer, with Josh Parrish joining me here in the studio. And welcome to your favourite program, Evenings on FNR. It's a pleasure to have your company tonight. It's our last show for the season, and there is plenty to get through over the next 60 minutes, so don't go anywhere. We'll be joined by Sydney Morning Herald's Dom Bossy at 5:45pm to go through the fallout of David Gallop. And we'll also hear from Football Victoria's referee manager, who is coming on to tell us about a new app that they've launched to help support young and budding referees here in the community. Remember, our lines are open. Please get involved at any time. Give us a call on 03 99 44 99 99, or you can tweet to us at FNR underscore radio, or comment below if you are with us on Facebook Live.
Good evening, Louise. Last episode for the season. We'll be taking a couple of weeks break after this program with the It's the depth of the off-season here in Australia, but we'll be back in 2 weeks if all goes well.
And we have had quite a long season, I would say, because we haven't stopped since, last Christmas?
Since the World Cup, really. Yeah, I guess we had a week off for Christmas, and that was
with the World Cup. We went right through.
Yeah, we didn't stop, so taking a couple of weeks break to rejuvenate, but your favourite club shows and so forth will still be available. All the Knights, Preston, Avondale, etc. and so on. Geelong Football Out West will still be going to air at their usual time, so don't worry about that.
Moving on, let's take a look at some of the latest news headlines. The Australian under-17 Joeys now know their fate for the FIFA under-17 World Cup after the draw revealed they will be in Group B alongside 2015 winners Nigeria. Elsewhere, Western Sydney Wanderers head coach Marcus Babbel has named his squad for next Saturday's historic game against English Championship club Leeds United.
Yeah, so a couple of high-profile friendlies coming up, which should be the first game at Bankwest Stadium, at least the first football match there, and I'm really looking forward to seeing that stadium in its full splendour.
And finally, 10,000 fans have flocked to Western Australia's cricket ground for Manchester United's opening training session, and we will come to that very shortly because Manchester United are kicking off their pre-season friendly with a match against Perth Glory tomorrow night.
Yeah, it's interesting to have Manchester United here, especially at this point in their cycle, because there's a lot of speculation about some of their star players, whether they'll be staying with the club or leaving. And, you know, it's interesting to have them in Australia while the global media circus unfolds.
That's exactly right. And as I said, let's go straight there. Manchester United in Perth. The Red Devils are in town for their pre-season tour, a match against Perth Glory tomorrow. And there was a cheeky dig by the club's arch rivals, Liverpool. And Liverpool couldn't help themselves but have a crack at United. An hour after training began, they flew a plane across the sky, and the message read, Liverpool FC, 6 times European champions.
Yeah, the Manchester United players weren't entirely thrilled with that one, but we've seen a few plane banners in recent years, most famously Arsenal fans with Wenger out and so forth, but yeah, this one, a little bit of trolling at the hands of the Liverpool fans, which we know they're everywhere in Australia.
They are. They're everywhere. And I wouldn't expect anything less from Liverpool. But so it goes. Manchester United are in town. Paul Pogba got a lot of attention yesterday. And all the fans, despite the fact that he's been heavily linked away, flocked to see him and get a selfie with him. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not he plays tomorrow.
Yeah, I think he's trying to put on a charm offensive at the moment with the fans, considering, you know, he was blamed for a lot of the problems last season, I think perhaps slightly unfairly, or maybe his influence on things was ballooned out of proportion. It's just because he's such a big personality. But Yeah, he's on a bit of a charm offensive. I'd be surprised to see him back at the club in the regular season. I suspect someone will come in for him with a big bid, but you know, it depends on whether the likes of Real Madrid can find the funds.
Well, that's it. And Juventus are also in the running as well. So it depends which club he wants to go to and who ends up breaking the bank for him.
Yeah, I wonder where his sort of stock is at the moment, because he obviously won the World Cup with France, but his club form has been inconsistent so far. So, yeah, I'm not sure what's going on with Paul Pogba and where his market value is right now, because the market is extremely inflated and United, given his commercial value to them off the park, would not want him to leave for anything less than 100 million, or at least what they bought him for.
Well, that's it. And maybe that's why it's taking a little bit of time for other clubs to show their interest and get the money together.
Yeah, I would agree.
Josh, we might take a quick break, our first break for the show, but we'll be back with plenty more.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Welcome back to Evenings here on FNR. Just struggling with a few technological difficulties. A Facebook live stream not behaving itself today, but you can go watch us on our Twitter page. That's on Periscope. On at FNR underscore radio is our handle. We'll cross post our Twitter and YouTube links to the Facebook page, which doesn't seem to be kicking off the stream today. Don't know whether it's to do with the inclement weather outside, Louise. Maybe playing haywire with our internet connection.
Oh, probably. Or Facebook down, as it usually is.
But yeah, it's not the most stable streaming platform, unfortunately, but we will crack on with the program.
That we will. We were talking about Manchester United, who are in town. They have a friendly against Perth Glory tomorrow night. Let's look at how the teams will line up, because we know that Manchester United haven't played a competitive game since their last fixture in the English Premier League last season, which ended poorly against Cardiff City, who were in the relegation zone, 2-0 to them. And Manchester United lined up with many of the players who are currently on tour in Australia. Will they go with the same lineup, or do you think that they might opt to play some of their new arrivals?
Well, you would have thought that they will play some of the younger players. They are bringing, you know, mostly full strength, if you call it that, squad.
Do you think that they'll play younger players, though, given that we're just under a month away from the start of the English Premier League season?
I'm sure it'll be a mixture. I think some of the younger players will get a go, as we usually see in these friendlies overseas. I would be interesting to see Aaron Wan-Bissaka getting his debut at right back. And Daniel James has come over from Swansea as well. I think will probably feature.
The two 21-year-olds.
But I can't imagine Paul Pogba not playing, at least getting a half. I think you'll see David De Gea, Marcus Rashford, Jesse Lingard and Luke Shaw as well.
Okay. And obviously David De Gea, as you say, will be in goal. I'm really looking forward to seeing if young Mason Greenwood gets his shot. He did play in that last English Premier League game against Cardiff City. He started alongside Marcus Rashford. So whether or not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer opts for that duo up front is, well, we'll have to wait and see. But I would love to see him play against Perth Glory. Manchester United don't really know anything about Perth Glory, and Rashford admitted that. It's a massive unknown for them. Rashford doesn't know if it's going to be a whitewash or if it's going to be something a little bit more closer. And I don't think we even know, because it's hard to gauge where Manchester United really are at the moment.
Well, let's have a listen to some of what Marcus Rashford had to say to the media.
Yeah, 100%. I just think like little things like pictures in our heads are a lot clearer already. You know, some of the other lads have been in pre-season longer than I have, but in the short time I've been here, things are becoming more clear to me on what the manager wants and how we're to do it on the pitch. So, you know, like you said, it'll put us in good stead for the rest of the season.
So these pre-season games, obviously very important for United to get into the swing of things. Do you know how many of these youngsters have made the trip, the likes of Teith, Chong and so forth, in the squad?
Chong is in the squad. You've got Mason Greenwood, you've got Angel Gomez, who's another young one who actually made his debut coming on in a game for Wayne Rooney. And Wayne Rooney is his idol, so what a moment that would be for a young player. As I said, Mason Greenwood and even James Garner has made the trip across to Australia. So they're just a few that have come on board. But you can see that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has come from that generation where he does know and value the importance of youth and bringing youth through. And given that that is a large part of Manchester United's identity, I think that he's only too keen to continue that on moving forward.
I think he does have that sort of DNA from his time at the club. You know, if you're good enough, you are old enough. I'm interested to see Axel Tuanzebe in defence, because that's been the point of weakness, in my opinion, for Manchester United in the past few years, just the middle of the defence. I do like Victor Lindelof, but I think he's, you know, the only one who's really proved his consistency. Eric Bailly had a very good first season, if you remember, but then has been very often injured and just very inconsistent in seasons, ensuing seasons, I should say. But then you've got players like Chris Smalling and Phil Jones, who are just really bugbears of the supporters. They can't believe these guys have been on such long contracts and been there for so long when, you know, players of their calibre at Manchester United in the past would have been, you know, shipped on to lower Premier League clubs long ago.
And then you even have young Scott McTominay, who has been... And he was around when Jose Mourinho was at the helm, so he's come through and got quite a few amount of minutes under his belt. I think he will feature too against Perth Glory.
Yeah, I think he will. Scott McTominay is a weird one because he's a promising young player, of course, but he's only really in the first team squad because back a couple of seasons ago, Jose Mourinho wanted to make a point to Paul Pogba, so he benched him for that severe Champions League game and put this youngster in instead, who is physical, will do defensive work, and will do exactly what the manager says, which is, you know, maybe what Paul Pogba wasn't bringing to the side. So it was almost he was caught in the middle of this political duel between Mourinho and Pogba, and that's how he cracked into the first team. I'm not totally convinced that he's Manchester United quality. But, you know, he does offer, you know, very specific characteristics, that work rate, you know, winning those aerial duels, winning 50-50s in midfield that, you know, a lot of managers do value. And you know, I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer wants to play a much more high-pressing game this season, which Manchester United really haven't caught up to what's been the, you know, the prevailing trend in European football, because the players haven't been conditioned that way. And Solskjaer was complaining about the players' fitness last season when he took over, saying that they couldn't press for long periods because they just weren't conditioned properly. So maybe this preseason will be vitally important for him to play his game style.
And the preseason certainly reflects something different as to what happened in season for them. They have been running and running and running, and that's all they seem to have been doing. The players are actually getting a little bit concerned because they're like, where is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's tactical depth? Is it even there? So they're questioning it themselves. But really, we know, as you touch on, Ole is just focusing on getting them fit for the long and arduous Premier League season which lies ahead. Now I think would be the best time for Manchester United to really focus on getting that attack to become really fluid. As you touch on, we've got the two new players who have arrived. I'm really looking forward to seeing how Bissaka goes and how he might be able to link up with a Rashford or with, you know, a young Mason Greenwood, whoever he ends up putting up top.
Yeah, or even a Lingard on the right-hand side. Wan-Bissaka is a very good defensive fullback. He wasn't offered the opportunity to get forward at Crystal Palace too much, and his statistics in that department in terms of crosses and dribbles up the flank, you know, they're just not that impressive. But he was playing in a team that was very defensive, that did demand a stay-at-home right back, and then you basically pass it to Wilfried Zaha in transition, and that's how they stayed up. Whereas now he will be expected to get forward, and we'll maybe see his attacking characteristics slowly develop.
Hopefully. As for Perth Glory, I think that Tony Popovic might be able to throw in some of the young players in this upcoming match.
Let's see what he had to say.
It's a very big game, I think, for just not just in terms of football, but I think as a sporting spectacle. One of the greatest organisations in sport, not just in football, is here in Manchester United, and I think everyone we can already see in WA is embracing that, and we as a football club are embracing the opportunity to play against them. We'd like them to remember this city, remember Perth Glory as well, and that's up to us to put in a very good performance, the best we can, that we can leave them obviously happy with the experience Man U's had here in Perth with the hospitality, but also to know that they had a good game of football against an A-League side.
That is Perth Glory's head coach Tony Popovic chatting there. And Josh, no doubt we will be seeing former Melbourne City star Bruno Fornaroli make his debut for the Glory.
Well, that's the number one thing I'm interested in seeing. How does that forward line work? It was a forward line that won the Premier's plate and got them to a grand final. Where does he fit in? Who does he displace? Do they try and accommodate all of their star attackers into one lineup? Can he coexist with Andy Keogh? All these questions abound ever since, you know, that story came out that he was coming across from Melbourne City. And what will he look like after a whole season of not playing? He only played 2-3 games for Melbourne City last season, and then he was sitting up in the stands drinking mate with his daughter in his lap for the rest of the campaign. I guess he has been training for the last few months ever since he came over sort of mid-season and he was released from his Melbourne City contract after the transfer window closed. But what does that do for a player who's not exactly in his younger days of his career? Will he be physically affected by that time out from the game? All these questions may be answered.
That's it. I think that given he's been over in Western Australia for a few months now, hopefully he's been working on his fitness. I know that he did make his first appearance for Perth Glory off camera and away from all the public in a friendly against Bayswater City. Now, in that same friendly, we also saw Tony Popovic's two sons score and bag a goal themselves. So could the goals be coming from somewhere else if Popovic chooses to play his sons?
Well, they certainly look like a talented prospect. I don't imagine it's an easy thing for a professional coach to have his sons in the setup, because I'm sure every time they're selected, there'll be murmurings of nepotism and so forth. But they, you know, if they're as talented as Tony Popovic was as a player, then you know, you're in for a really quality prospect, because Popovic, let's not forget, I mean, he's been a very fine manager, but he was one of the great Socceroos defenders of the last few decades.
That's exactly right. And his right-hand man is Richard Garcia, former Premier League player himself. He's currently also head of Perth Glory's youth team, so he knows very well all the talent there that he has that could be in line to play against Manchester United on Saturday night. And this is what Garcia had to say.
I think they're very excited. It's a good way to start off our season. And, you know, for some of those guys, it's an experience I'll never forget.
And for you personally, from your days as a player, did you have much luck against United?
No luck at all. It was always a tough game and, you know, they'd always punish us for the slightest mistake. So, it was always a game we relished, but it never had much success.
And for the Glory themselves, they had a fantastic season last year, topping the table, obviously not winning the grand final, but things are going well here.
Definitely. The manager's come in and he's put a new spin on the way we do things, and it's fantastic. The place is really going from strength to strength, and we're looking to back up the success of last year and go that one step further and win the grand final. And this is a fantastic start to that campaign, you know, a match-up against a fantastic team that, you know, will just get the boys invigorated for the season ahead.
That was Richard Garcia, Tony Popovic's right-hand man and the head of the youth team over at Perth Glory, talking about the prospect of facing United. And as he said, Louise, he knows all about the quality that they pose, having made so many appearances for Hull City in the Premier League over the course of his career. Just before we leave United, there's been talk in the papers overseas that Inter have made contact with United over signing Romelu Lukaku.
That's exactly right. Inter officials actually flew to the United Kingdom to meet with Manchester United officials and basically decide what is going to happen with Lukaku. I don't know if Manchester United will budge on this, because as we heard from Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in his press conference when he spoke to media in Western Australia, he said that no offers currently have actually been made for any of the players that are currently linked away. Pogba, Lukaku, Rashford, Lingard. Nothing has been made. So we know that Inter's first choice is Lukaku, but I'm also hearing that Eintracht Frankfurt's Rebic could be backup if they do not get Lukaku.
It's interesting that they'd be going after those two, because they couldn't really be more different. I mean, Rebic is this hardworking winger He doesn't really score too many goals. And Lukaku is a total target man who his lack of mobility has been, you know, something that everyone is criticised. I mean, neither of them have a particularly good first touch. I think that's the thing they both have in common. But
who would you take, Lukaku or Rebic?
Look, they're totally different players. I'm not a huge fan of either of them. I think Rebic, he works in his situation in Germany because they play a sort of football that really it suits him because he just has space in transition and doesn't have to rely on close technical ability and just his raw pace and work rate. I don't know if that works for Inter in Serie A. He would work very hard even as a wing back perhaps in under Antonio Conte, but Lukaku, well, I'd certainly be concerned about how much you'd have to pay for him considering his game has dropped off so much since United signed him. I mean, remember when he was at Everton and he was, you know, one of the hottest properties in world football, even back when he was, you know, at Chelsea and it looked like he was going to be the next Didier Drogba. But he seems to have taken a huge hit in his confidence. He needs to get out of there. Maybe Inter is a place to rejuvenate his career.
Manchester United are demanding no less than €85 million for Romelu Lukaku.
I mean, that would be the sale of the century if Ed Woodward was able to pull that off. You know, if I was Inter, I'd be saying you should pay us to take this guy. I mean, he would be on very high wages as well, so that would be a costly deal. I know Inter have pretty wealthy management from ownership, I should say, from China now, but I don't think that's a good investment.
I don't think it's good for both parties because, for me, Lukaku is weighing Manchester United down at the moment. Mm. I mentioned on a number of the shows that there are a number of players who are dead wood. They need to be cleared out, and Manchester United need to start bringing in and signing fresh new talent if they want to get back into the Champions League contention. It's not going to happen if they don't, because you've got these players like a Lukaku, like a Paul Pogba, who don't even want to be at the club. So what is that going to do to the rest of the team? That mood and that environment is going to only permeate within the rest of the other within the other players. So, you know, it's going to bring everyone else down. It's not good for any collective performance.
I think Lukaku's biggest problem is the amount of, I don't know, I think it's muscle mass, but the amount of weight he's actually put on. He seems to have bulked, as they say, over the last few seasons. You can see it. I mean, you can see the comparison pictures of where he was, what his build was like when he first came to the club, and the kind of behemoth that he is now. He's totally lost his agility. He's packed on all this muscle, maybe because he wants to show off on Instagram or something, how much weight he can lift. Does that help him on the football field? It doesn't help him at all because...
No, he's clunky.
He's clunky. He's got this huge turning circle now, and he's not the live player that we saw in the past. He had this massive build, but he was also like very agile, very quick, very dangerous on the dribble. He doesn't have that anymore because he's just put on too much weight. And it's a brutal reality of it. I don't want to body shame the guy, but it's the reality. And that's his main problem for me. I don't know where his head is at the moment as well. Maybe mentally his game has suffered.
So you think that maybe Inter might pick Rebic over Lukaku if it comes down to that, if Manchester United actually aren't willing to part ways with Lukaku because they have put such a big figure on his head? If we look at Rebic, the 25-year-old has scored 22 goals across three seasons for Eintracht Frankfurt. As you touch on, it's not enough.
It's not. He's not really a striker. He's a winger. I mean, I could see him as a wing back in a 3-5-2 that Conte might like to play. So he's not. He's definitely not a striker. He can maybe play up front with another more out and out number nine. But you know, even then, I don't think that's his best position necessarily. He might work in a defensive sense for Conte, but maybe going forward. But I can see him going there for the simple reason that the team is so stacked with Croatians. They seem to have this diaspora forming there with Brozovic and Veselko and Perisic as well. They've tried to sign Modric. They've tried to sign Rakitic in the past. They tried to sign...
All the itches.
Yeah, pretty much. Kovacic as well from Chelsea they tried to sign. So, you know, they're basically a home away from home for the Croatian national team. And I think Rebic would want to go there for that very reason, because he knows all these guys from the World Cup side. And you know, why wouldn't you want to play with those teammates?
And maybe that's what they're trying to build at Inter Milan, a replica of Croatia who took out the FIFA World Cup back in 2018.
Well, it didn't quite. They got to the final.
That's close enough.
They did exceptionally well. I mean, and, you know, if I think it's worth building up those bonds. I think a lot of good national teams are formed on the basis of a few of those players playing together at club level, and they're trying it vice versa. A few players from a successful national team that get along really well, that gel really well together, and then you bring into a club environment, and that will help both teams. So I can see Rebic working in Inter for that reason, even if I'm not crazy about him individually as a player.
And of course, we know that all clubs in Serie A want to bridge that gap between top of the tree, Juventus. They just seem to be winning it season in, season out, and no one even gets close. So the more that these other clubs like your Inters, like your Romas, can start to do better business in the off-season, the closer they hopefully will get in season.
And let's not forget what a fantastic manager that Inter have. I mean, you know, he gets a lot out of not much, if you will. He is maximising the talent that he has, and he always does it everywhere he goes. So I think he will put up a fight against Juve next season, but it's looking difficult with Sarri coming in and the players that he has at his disposal. De Ligt should be signing soon. That team is they're basically the Death Star of Italian football, and it's going to take a lot to stop them from winning Serie A again.
What's been happening with Napoli? We haven't really heard too much about Napoli. They took out second place in Serie A 2018-19. They've been a little bit quiet throughout this summer transfer window. As of Atalanta, who surprisingly finished third. What a fairy tale that was.
Atalanta were a joy to watch, and they play some fantastic football. Whether they can replicate that, I'm not sure. Napoli have gone about their business quite quietly, but I think if they can just keep most of their squad together, they'll be doing well, because they're a kind of team that everyone tries to poach their best players at the end of every successful season.
That's exactly right. It seems to be the case, but as you say, I think that Inter Milan, very interesting to see what happens throughout the next couple of days. Will Lukaku go? Will Manchester United let go of him? And more importantly, we did hear that Paul Pogba's agent, Mino Raiola, has become really disinterested and quite angry with the way Manchester United have handled that situation, given the fact that Paul doesn't want to be at the club. And it seems that he's still there and has to bear the brunt of it until he finds a new contract.
Just before we leave Napoli, we shouldn't forget that they did sign Manolas from Roma, which is a massive pickup. He's one of the best centre-backs in the entire league. But yes, the Pogba saga will roll on all summer, and especially while he's here in Australia, we will be bringing it to you. But yeah, I think he's surely not going to be able to stay at the club.
And before we go to our guest, Josh, I want a score prediction from you. Manchester United taking on Perth Glory tomorrow night at Optus Stadium, 9 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time kickoff. Who is going to win and what is the score going to be?
I think United will win. I'm going to say 3-1.
That's what I was going to say.
Read your mind.
Who's going to score then?
Oh, I think we might see one of the youngsters get a goal. I'm going to say maybe a Mason Greenwood getting on the score sheet.
You're reading my mind.
Yeah, I think
I want to say Rashford as well. Yeah, Rashford should score.
Yeah, I would pick that. Maybe Pogba will get a goal and try and put some of those transfer rumours to bed, but they're not going anywhere regardless of the result.
No, but it is his time to shine. The fans in Australia are loving him at the moment. And why not bag a few goals against Perth Glory if you can?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Louise Taffer with Josh Parrish joining me here in the studio. And all first-year football referees across Victoria will soon have new technology to assess their performance, monitor instances of abuse, and constantly track their mental and physical well-being, which seems a bit revolutionary in this space, Josh. Joining us now is Football Victoria's referee manager, Luke Brennan. Luke, thank you so much for coming on FNR.
Hi, Louise. Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Luke. What can you tell us about this new app?
Yeah, well, we've partnered with Melbourne tech company RefLive, and we're launching a new app to our first-year referees. And the app simply asks the referees to answer 10 questions after each game. They will answer 6 questions regarding their self-assessment around positioning, fitness, decision-making and communication. They'll then answer 2 questions regarding the home and away team behaviour, 1 question about the match organisation of the home team, and finally the last question will be around their overall well-being on that particular game so that we can then track that data and reach out to our referees through our referee branch network across regional and metropolitan Victoria to support any of those referees who haven't had a great experience for whatever reason, and just give them that sort of coaching and support so that when they step out for their next match, they're better prepared.
Hi, Luke. It's Josh here. How big a problem is referee retention in Victoria?
So, Josh, roughly around 30% of referees don't come back from 1 year to the next. And particularly what we're focusing on with this app as we launch it is first-year referees who churn at around about 40% each year. So the more we can do in this space, the more resources and support we can give to our referees, the better it's going to be for us to help retain them from 1 year to the next and keep them involved and make them better referees to go on and have a great refereeing career.
Absolutely. I know FV's been running a lot of Respect the Game campaigns and so forth, but you know, having this app, it must streamline the process of referees, you know, reporting unsavoury incidents or abuse quite a lot.
Yes, it will. Particularly for us, the sort of any of the incidents that occur, you know, unsavoury sort of stuff, will still be reported through the usual channels that they do. But this is to be more, you know, more connected directly to our referees. We've got just over 1,400 referees right across Victoria, which has been a growth of 47% over the last four seasons, which is great. And we want to keep growing on that. We've got a strategic plan for 3,000 referees by the end of 2022. So it's ambitious, but it's something that we're really keen to work hand in hand with football and the clubs. And also across, you know, various stakeholder groups, so we can have a great pool of, you know, high functioning referees and supporting the growth of the game.
I have refereed some games myself, Luke, at a low level, and I know it can be a bit of a, you know, isolating experience. Is part of this app really building a support network for these inexperienced and new referees?
Yes, it is, and it probably just builds on the great work that our referee branches are already doing. We've got 12 referee branches who are essentially a referee community in metropolitan regional Victoria that provide referees with that opportunity to get out on the park each week and support their referees through coaching. So, you know, I think maybe as you would have experienced it, suburban level refereeing is probably the loneliest place. It's you know, people often say, oh, you know, it must be difficult refereeing in big stadiums and so forth. But, you know, your community fixtures are the ones where, you know, it's the young referee going out on the weekend where they're most likely to, you know, be targeted kind of abuse, and that's the kind of thing that we don't want to see. We want to see, you know, football embracing referees and seeing them as a key part of the game, and retaining them involved in the game so that they can then grow and become better referees.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about the company behind this. I understand they're from Melbourne, but this technology has already been used in places outside of Victoria quite extensively.
Yeah, so we've partnered with Simon Murphy and his team down at RefLive, who are a Melbourne tech startup. They originally launched with a smartwatch app for referees. So it was sort of an app that would replace essentially the referee's notebook in their pocket. And then with the development we've done with Simon over the last few years, we've actually sort of grown, you know, what it is that we feel is really important from refereeing, just, you know, in addition to their smartwatch app, so that referees can then have this wellbeing app that's going to support them even better than they have in the past.
So will this app just be launched for the first-year referees, or will it be branching out to all of the referees in Victoria?
So it'll be first-year referees initially, and then we want to expand that out into all referees right across all levels of football as we go forward.
So does this present some sort of professional development opportunities as well as, you know, highlighting instances of abuse?
Yes, it does. So part of the questioning that we've got in the referee self-assessment on the app is also the same questions that we ask our referee mentors. So the referees can then compare their own self-assessment with that of their mentor who assesses them on their performance in their first season. So it sort of ties in well with that. That allows us to then, you know, best support these referees. I think also too, the branch network does a really good job in supporting these referees, but we want to give them more insight into their referees, and the app and the data that's collected allows us to do that in a real time. I suppose in the past, you know, we've got to the end of a season where we see a referee who's left the game, we ask them why they left the game. This is much more proactive, it's much more real-time, and it allows us to do it on a weekly basis. So we're really looking forward to it.
So that means that you're able to step in maybe sooner rather than losing a referee and then looking for answers later.
Yeah, correct. So last season, we actually trialled this as in an offline trial through our Mornington Peninsula branch. And And what it really highlighted was that there was reoccurring themes that we could see between, you know, referees, clubs, and even the data then allowed us to see particular teams within clubs, and we could take proactive action with those clubs, go and have a chat to, you know, a coach or to whoever at the club just about a particular incident. And clubs are really great in embracing that and saying, oh, listen, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't realise the effect that it was having on the referee. And people are able to change their behaviour, and the referee stayed involved in the game and the coach kept coaching his team. So it was a win-win for everyone.
Well, it sounds like fantastic development, Luke. I did want to ask you about, you know, the elite level as well in NPL Victoria. What's been your assessment of the refereeing and the incidents so far this season? Do you feel it's been a positive campaign?
Yeah, it has actually. Yeah, really happy to date with how things are going. I mean, of course, you know, as with all levels of football, everyone will always have their opinions on the performance of the referees. But by and large, we're really happy with their performances across the year to date. It's been going really well.
Excellent. Well, Luke, thank you so much for joining us. Ref Live sounds like a really interesting development. We wish you all the best with the rollout.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks, Louise.
Luke Brennan, the FV referee manager, joining us here on Evenings on FNR, talking about Ref Live, which is a new app that all the first-year referees will soon have at their disposal. And it's basically, you know, trying to stop some of the factors that turn referees away from the game. You heard that statistic, 40% of new referees, first-year referees, actually don't come back the next year. So if you can reverse that trend, I mean, the game will be much healthier in the state.
It will be, and especially as they move towards a more professional career, you know, referees are vital to our game, as we know, at all levels. So we need to be producing lots of good referees who can do the job and supporting them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the quality of referees is always a talking point in the A-League, but it starts at the grassroots level. Every referee needs to get their experience, you know, at a suburban level before they progress up the ranks. You don't just suddenly become an A-League caliber quality official. So if, you know, some of those refs may be discouraged by negative early experiences, and if you can stop that where it starts and really make some changes, then maybe you'll retain some referees who will go on to bigger and better things down the track.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've got to really have a thick skin in this game, because there are some nasty parents out there who are on the sidelines, and I think that's where quite a lot of the abuse might come from.
Yeah, I think it does come from spectators in my experience as well, just as, you know, some Saturday morning sport and some futsal as well, you often get spectators involved. You know, if it's from the players, you can kind of excuse it to a degree because there's, you know, all of that adrenaline involved. But once it gets, you know, to the parents, you've got to be setting an example on the sideline. And I think, as Luke highlighted, maybe highlighting some of those early behaviours and giving feedback to the clubs as well and to the spectators can help stop those unhealthy behaviours from occurring and becoming patterns.
We might take a quick break, because coming up is the Sydney Morning Herald's Dom Bossi.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Louise Taffer with Josh Parrish joining me here in the studio for another edition of Evenings on FNR, our last for the season, but don't worry, we will be back quite soon. Remember, you can get involved, send us a tweet at FNR_radio or give us a call. We have about 15 minutes left on the show. That number is 0399 44 9999. Now, last night in Zurich, we saw that FIFA were doing the draw for the under-17 FIFA World Cup, which is commencing in October. Very exciting, because one of our youth national teams has finally qualified for the tournament.
How long has it been?
No, this one, it's okay.
Okay.
We qualified for the previous one, which was in 2015.
Right.
And our Joeys have also qualified for this edition, which is in Brazil. So very exciting. The Joeys, compared to the Joeys who participated in the 2015 one in Chile, they were in the group of death, but the Joeys are not in the group of death this time around. They're in Group B alongside Ecuador, Hungary, and also 2015 champions, Nigeria.
Nigeria, who, let's say they're a controversial team at this level. There's been a few scandals in years past of them fielding overage players.
That's exactly right. When I was watching the under-17 FIFA World Cup in Chile, I was obviously following the Joeys quite closely, And they were in that group of death, which was Group C, Mexico, Germany, and also Argentina. They got out of the group of death, which was just remarkable, where they faced Nigeria in the round of 16. Now, I think it was about 6-0. It was a thrashing. When I saw Nigeria at the time, there was no way, no way on this earth that they looked 17 or under.
I mean, some people are precocious developers, but we did see in 2016 the Nigerian team, they had several players ruled ineligible because they did
MRIs.
That would have been the same team a year later, and they did MRIs on their wrists, and you can actually tell via bone density
how old someone
really is. Sometimes it's accidental because in some parts of the world, birth certificates aren't that accurate. Some people don't have birth certificates. But in African football in particular, I mean, age fraud is rife and it's a real problem. And it actually damages African football down the line because, you know, you can win a Youth World Cup, but it doesn't mean anything when you've got a bunch of, you know, 25-year-olds in your team. I mean, it doesn't help you develop players.
No, it doesn't. And quite frankly, if Australia had have won that game, they would have gone on to face Brazil, which is where Nigeria also defeated them 3-0. Nigeria then went on to face Mexico, where they defeated them, and then finally beat Mali 2-0 in the World Cup final. So if they had have found that out at the time, the Joey's fate could have been a lot different. They wouldn't have exited in the round of 16. But now Trevor Morgan's youngsters will have an interesting test ahead of them in this Group B at Brazil in October. I think that Nigeria will be a tough test, but you want to play against, you know, good countries.
Yeah.
It's good for the Joeys, especially because they don't get that much exposure as it is. We saw that they were invited to that UEFA tournament back in March, and that was only invitational. We don't ever get to play countries like that. So for the Joeys, it'll be a great test to be in this group. Hopefully they can get into the round of 16 and progress even further.
It's definitely doable. I think, you know, it's not going to be easy, but Ecuador and Hungary, they're not exactly powerhouses of youth world football. So the Joeys should have a decent chance of sneaking into that second spot and qualifying.
Yes, let's hope. And, of course, Nigeria have won it five times. They've won it the most. Mm. So you can understand why they are so dominant. But shifting our attention to some more news of the day and, more importantly, news of the week, it's time to cross to one of the country's most esteemed journalists, and that is the Sydney Morning Herald's Dom Bossi, who joins us now. Dom, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Dom, you've covered many, many events throughout football's rich history. What did you make of the news received yesterday that FFA's David Gallop will step down from his position in December?
Look, it's probably not a huge surprise. While it is a massive massive news in its own right, it's the first change of leadership really we've had in, you know, 7 years or so. I don't think it's much of a surprise because of the timing. It follows the A-League independence. The FFA will inherently undergo a bit of a restructure. It'll redefine its roles, its objectives, its tasks and so on. And I think the role of the chief executive will be significantly different.
Sorry, you're just dropping out a bit there, Dom.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, that's better.
Yeah, so look, I think it's I think the role of the chief executive will be redefined following the restructure that will inherently happen with the FFA, and it's probably the time for a change as well. I think there are definitely some desires for change from board members as well, and I think David Gallop probably steps out at the right time.
In your piece for the Sydney Morning Herald yesterday, Dom, you mentioned that he was more of a cautious and considered leader at a time where most football fans wanted ambition.
Yeah, I think that's probably been the main point of frustration from fans with Gallup's leadership. And it's not to say that that's necessarily correct, those frustrations, because I think he comes from a very cautious base and he's a pragmatic leader, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think what we've seen throughout the history of Australian football, that visionaries, whilst being important, don't always deliver great outcomes. I think probably, we could have done with a little bit more vision throughout the FFA as an organisation. That's not necessarily just Gallup. But that's probably been one of the points of frustration, that expansion took a long time to get going. The way the fan crisis was was handled wasn't great, but he also made some pretty big calls as well. You know, under his tenure, he did introduce the FFA Cup, which has been, in my opinion, probably the greatest tournament that's mended relationships between grassroots and professional tiers. You know, made the bold decision to sack Holger Osik on the eve of a World Cup and brought in Ange Postecoglou, delivered an Asian Cup. And, you know, he also launched a bid for the 2023 Women's World Cup, which, you know, we could win the hosting rights for.
So there could be some, you know, achievements down the line that he's not really around to take credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's with all leadership, you know, not just in sport, but in politics as well. You know, things take time to come to fruition. Look, I think there are reasons for some well-founded criticisms of his tenure, but I think there have been a lot of good moments as well.
To play devil's advocate then, Dom, I mean, I'm sure a lot of fans would argue that he showed a little bit of inaction that has allowed football and the A-League in particular to sort of stagnate. You mentioned the delaying of the expansion process, which could end up being, you know, costly, even if it was a more cautious move.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with those criticisms. I think the A-League needed a bit more energy put back into it. Now, it's a difficult thing. How does that happen? The expansion, I think, is something that needed to be addressed earlier. Mm. And whilst we do have two new teams that will enter in the next 2 years, that largely came about, what I've been informed, is a decision from Stephen Lowy, not Gallup himself. So that's probably the inaction of Gallup in that sense, and probably the criticism that come with that. I think that's probably quite fair. I think the FFA Cup has been a fantastic introduction as well. So it's important to probably take in all of it. And I think there's probably good and bad to all of those, and probably some fair criticisms, some that might not be completely. But that's probably the way I see it.
And how do you think Gallup's role has changed under the different chairmen?
Well, it's probably a bit of a tricky one, because the new board only became effective in November, and he's handed in his resignation 6-7 months after that. During that period, I think probably the biggest event that he had to oversee was the new league's working group, which moved on a strategic level the A-League to an independent model. But probably the one that he was most known for was the handling of the Alan Stajic sacking. And I'm not sure how much his role changed under the new board, apart from probably overseeing that independence of the A-League. That was something he was instructed for that was never contemplated under the guidance of the former board, the Stephen Lowy and Frank Lowy era. That's probably the most significant difference, I'd say.
It's interesting. We had George Danikian on the show yesterday, and his view was basically that it doesn't really matter who the CEO was, whether it's John O'Neill, whether it was Ben Buckley, David Gallup. It was, you know, the Lowys who were maybe holding back that release of power, and you know, the CEO ends up being the fall guy.
Yeah, look, that's one way of looking at it. It's no secret that Frank Lowy certainly ruled with a bit more of an autocratic style. He wasn't a conciliatory leader. He was definitely quite strong in his opinions and his beliefs. But that's also not to say that the CEO doesn't have control over other areas of a company. I think it's probably a bit simplistic to say that you're always going to be under the thumb of a ruler like that. I'm not privy to it, but I think there's probably some case for difficulties arising from it. But, you know, a CEO still have to oversee budgets, appointment of staff, hiring of staff. That's not the role of a board. Only a CEO does that. So the senior management is still comprised by a CEO. And I think that responsibility and influence still can be administered in that sphere.
I did want to return to 2015, you know, the A-League fan revolt, the security, the banning notices, really the period which led to a real decline in active support in the A-League. I mean, how much blame do you place on Gallup for that?
Good question. It's a good question, probably a difficult one to answer, because it's important to note that those frustrations was probably the culmination of the better part of a decade, right, of fans and unhappiness with stadium security, over-policing, the banning notices, which, correct me if I'm wrong, I think were in place before David Gallop came in. I think that was probably left over from the Ben Buckley era. So that's pretty important to take into account, but you also can't ignore the way it was handled at that point in time. I think going back, my memory was that the fans' frustration was that Gallop and Damien De Bowen as well at the time, the former head of the A-League, didn't defend the game and didn't defend the fans as strongly as the fans and the game wanted and needed. I think that's probably the fairest criticism you could probably mount against Gallop and De Bowen at the time. But I think it is still important to remember that it's a culmination of the better part of a decade that stemmed well before his era.
Dom, do you think that he's left the game fractured? Those comments came from SBS's Craig Foster yesterday. Yeah, I'd just like to know where you stand on where do you think Gallop has left the game moving forward?
Yeah, another interesting one. Has he left it fractured? I think it is fractured in the wake of his departure. Now, were those fractures did those fractures appear before? What was the extent of those fractures? Look, that's a really hard one to gauge. I mean, Australian football has always been problematic in a governance sense. There's always been very little unity. Has he healed those wounds? No, I don't think he has. However, how much of that is the role of a chair, and how much is the role of the CEO? I think probably a fair bit of that responsibility does also fall on the shoulders of the former Lowy administration. I think they created significant wedges within the game. I think they were quite divisive by the end. And I don't think Gallop probably did a great job at healing those wounds potentially created by others. But so to some extent, I do agree with that sentiment. But I think, again, like a lot of this stuff, you've got to look at the history of the game. And you've got to look at the history of relationships in football that go back decades, really. And I've never really felt that this game has got much unity.
Mm. I don't think the introduction of NCIP particularly helped that.
No, I was really disappointed with that. Mm. Really, really disappointed, because I don't think we really needed it back then. You know, the game, Australian football and the culture of football had pretty much been whitewashed in 2004. Whatever ethnic clubs existed were operating at a pretty small level. They were out of sight, out of mind for the majority of mainstream media, mainstream public, that it just seemed like a bit overkill, right? You know, and it prevented cases of, do you remember Melbourne Knights being denied a sponsorship deal with a Croatian community club? And it's like, you know, you've taken Melbourne Knights out of the NSL. They're away from the spotlight. Yeah, there aren't many opportunities for clubs to earn a crust. And if they have to rely on their community groups, then great. You know, we should be embracing that. And I think there might have been a case, was it maybe Broadmeadow, who were denied having the Macedonian Sun on the back of their jersey. And it's like, well, what are we doing? What's our objective if we're obstructing that? And that was really disappointing. That, I thought, was a clear case of overkill. You know, that the game had already moved away from those communities, and I think really we needed to probably embrace it rather than really stamp out whatever embers were left of it. I was very disappointed in that. That was probably a dark moment for Australian football in its entirety.
Yeah, I think that was salt in still open wounds. Dom, to wrap this up, what sort of a leader do you think FFA needs now, given that the role has changed? It's, you know, not really about the A-League anymore with the independence coming in. What sort of leader does it need, and are there any names that spring to mind?
There are a few names that spring to mind, and I think there's one overriding type of leader that we need, and that is a football person. We can't go bring someone in from rugby union. We can't bring another bloke from AFL. You know, any other code won't cut it. We need people with skin in the game, people that still have to show up to their community games and that care enough about this game. And I'm not saying that, you know, David Gallop necessarily didn't care about the game and so on, but I think we've just also got enough football IP in operation at a high level of administration throughout the game that we need to bring them in-house and put them up at the highest position that we have. I think it sends a clear message of faith within a game by doing that. The names that come to mind, look, I've heard a few touted, not necessarily my opinions, but the ones touted are people like John Didlitzer at the PFA. I think I also do agree. I think he's done a great job there. Danny Townsend at Sydney FC has probably been floated about. There's a few other names. Peter Philopoulos at Football Victoria. So, look, it's still very early. I mean, who knows if they want the job?
Yeah, absolutely.
The process hasn't started in terms of appointing a new chief executive. There's just a few names that have kind of been flowing around. But we've got the people in the game now to lead our game, and that's what we need. And we need people who've got a proven record of diplomacy, who can heal these fractures, that can bring people in together. And it's a huge opportunity to do a lot now that the A-League is out of the FFA's control.
Well, Dom,
they don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as you say, now is probably the best time for David Gallop to step away as they move into the independent A-League.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Dom, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us on Evenings on FNR, and we'll speak to you soon.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
That was the Sydney Morning Herald's Dom Bossy joining us there to talk about FFA boss David Gallop, who has announced he won't see out his full tenure and will step down in December.
Yeah, it's a huge story. I think there's some good reflections from Dom there on the tenure. It's amazing. He is actually the longest chief executive in Australian football history, longest serving, which is crazy because how unpopular was he? I mean, we saw from anything we put on social media about it, the backlash is just incredible. I think that reflects wider frustrations with the game. Not all of those problems were of his doing, but he also didn't fix a lot of them, and there's a big job ahead of the next in line, although it is, of course, a different role. It will focus more on the youth national teams, the senior national teams, growing the game, youth development, not so much about commerciality and the A-League, which of course will be running off its own back.
Well, that's it. The A-League will be running off its own back, but they'll still have to find major sponsors because they'll still need money to fund the national teams.
And they will get a slice of the money coming into the A-League as well. That's part of the deal for the new independent A-League. And of course, FFA retains good of the game sort of veto rights on a lot of the issues that will come before the new independent A-League. So they are a sort of golden shareholder there. So there's still a lot of responsibility for the CEO, but it's not quite as all-encompassing as it used to be. And whoever steps into those big shoes, I mean, they've got a lot of priorities to hit. And I think healing those divides in the game is one of the main ones.
That's exactly right. And as you said, they won't have as much responsibility as what past CEOs once did. Josh, that's all we've got time for today, but thank you so much for joining me here in the studio. And as always, it's bye for now.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR, Football Nation Radio.